Today's guest is Jeffrey Round, who is a director, a playwright, a publisher, a songwriter. Jeff, why are you here?
Well, because I am, like you, a fellow scribbler.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shreve.
Hi, this is Brad, and welcome to Queer Writers of Crime. So glad you're with us today. My guest is my friend Jeffrey Round, one of my favorite people to talk to. He is amazingly busy and does so many things. And yet when you talk to him, he's just so chilled. I haven't figured it out how he does it. So there's lots of aspects to the thing that you do, Jeff. But last time you were here, you sang some songs. You can't really direct a stage play right now or any of the other things. I'd like to hear some of your poetry. Are you up for that?
I am definitely up for some poetry, yes.
Oh, let's start with that.
Okay. This is from my new book. It's called Threads. It's from Beautiful Dreamer Press. The editor is Louis Cici. I would call him Louis Cecchi, but he likes Louis Cici. This poem is called Small Furies. Beware silence. Distrust stillness. Things that lie beneath the surface do not seem. Death leaps up sudden, like trout from still water, snatching flies mid-air, or a car overleaping the banks of a sidewalk, pedestrians scattered midstream.
Very nice.
Thank you.
I enjoyed that as much as your singing the last time you were on.
I should say, even though I am known to be a queer mystery writer, poetry is something that I've been doing for a very long time. This is my second book of poems. This one deals specifically with LGBTQ themes. I was actually surprised how dark the content was when I saw it all laid out as a collection. And so it actually does very much fit in with the theme of death, to the degree that the title poem, Threads, is about a queer bashing. So it's that ultimately became a case of manslaughter, a murder. So it does fit in nicely with your theme, with your show.
Well, you said it's darker than you expected. Why do you think that is?
I guess because when I'm writing, I don't sit and think about how dark something is. I just think about whether it's actually working for me on the page. It's only when I take myself out of it and look back at it, sometimes after many years. In fact, there are a couple of poems in here that are more than two decades old. That's when I get to see what it's really all about and what the impetus was with the writing behind it all.
After you write something and you look back, does it ever surprise you that maybe you were in a frame of mind that you didn't on the surface see?
It often does that. I think that's one of the beauties and one of the joys of writing is to explore and let yourself go to places that you don't know you're going to or that you don't necessarily expect to go. I was rereading an email that you had sent earlier today in which you said that people got the impression from something you said on the show that you don't know where you're going when you're going there because you don't know what the idea is that you're following. In that regard, you were talking about your characters in particular. You said, I don't know where they're going to go next. And I think that is pretty much the standard for when I set out to write something, whether it's a story or whether it's a poem. I don't always know where I'm going. And I think that frees me up to write it as honestly and truthfully as possible, as opposed to driving it someplace that I want it to go or that I expect it to go. So I think that's the kind of thing that you were talking about in that email.
Yeah, and actually I have a question for you because it's the same question I asked Marshall Thornton last month. And it has to do with this because I just kind of flippantly said, you know, I don't know where I'm going to go with this. And the reason I put that in the newsletter is I do have ideas. I have probably two routes I want to take, and I'm not sure which. But here's the question I asked Marshall, and I'm going to quote. Usually my reviews, I have somebody read them for me, and then they come back and give me a synopsis of what they're all about. Because we know you can hear 100 good reviews, and then the one bad one knocks you down. So, but I did read this in Goodreads. In my first novel, there was a slight love interest that people really latched onto and liked. In the second novel, it got rocky. Some people who even liked the book found that disturbing. And here's what they said, and I want you to give me feedback on this. The review said, "I hope Brad isn't going the same route as Marshall Thornton did in blank and Jeffrey Round did in blank and kill or move on from his love interest to make his stories more interesting in the future." What do you have to say about that?
Wow, how boring those stories would be if they don't go up and down. I mean, that would, you know, we're not painting a pretty picture from the beginning. We're trying to create a journey. And if the character doesn't have a journey to go on, if there's no ups and downs, it would be pretty boring to follow, is what I would say. I'm trying to think who I killed off, though. I sometimes let the main character's love interests go off on a tangent sometimes, but in many cases they would come back and try to resolve whatever had been there before. That might be referring to one particular book of mine where the reason the protagonist, Bradford Fairfax, goes on his journey that propels him into a mystery that he has to solve is because a lover has died. And apparently it's a drug overdose, but it turns out to be anything but. But normally, no, I don't kill off too many love interests because they're very interesting. And even if the affair doesn't last, sometimes you want to bring them back to say, look, this is what could have been, and isn't it all the more poignant for that? And it makes your protagonist more human that person suffers rather than having everything go well and nice and all wrapped up in a bow.
Well, your P-Town, or you're not, I was going to say your P-Town Murders, that actually is the name of the first novel, but it's the Bradley Fairfax mystery series. What intrigues me about that is one of my first mystery writers that I really fell in love with was Gregory MacDonald, and he wrote the Fletch series. There's a lot of humor in it. Usually I think movies really screw up when they pick cast members, and Chevy Chase was perfect in that role. But I liked it because there was humor in it. And your first three novels are funny as compared to the next series, Dan Sharp, which is, let's say, darker. Nicely. Dan isn't as carefree. We'll get to Dan. I want to hear about the first series. Tell us about Bradford.
Okay. My answer may surprise you. I started off as a poet and a literary novelist, I thought. But when I couldn't sell my second novel, which it eventually was sold and became published, a book called The Honey Locust. It was about the Bosnian War that was taking place in the 1990s as I was writing it. But when I couldn't sell that, the war was over and people had lost interest in the war, I thought, what is going to sell? And I thought, well, you know, cookbooks sell and children's books sell, and I don't think I want to write either of those, but also mysteries sell. So I decided I would write a mystery, but I wasn't ready to take the genre seriously. So that's why it came out as a comic novel. The Bradford Fairfax series was actually given birth in Provincetown. So that's why the first one is the P-Town Murders. I was just wandering around and I kept meeting all these interesting people. Some of them were tourists, a lot of them were locals. And they all were a little bit edgy and a little bit strange. And I thought, you people are like characters in a strange murder mystery. And at that moment, the idea for the murder mystery actually popped into my head. I thought, okay, I'm going to follow where this leads. I was staying at a very interesting place. I had friends who lived in Boston at the time, and I was traveling down there to go camping, meaning literally camping with a tent, sleeping bag, all of that. So I drove to Boston to meet my friends first. And Janice, the woman, said, are you sure you really want to camp? And I said, well, you know, I don't have a lot of money, and that's what I came down here to do. And she said, well, my boss actually just bought a house there. She said, I think I can talk him into letting you stay at the house. I said, well, you know, I really can't afford, like, you know, these really expensive guest house. She said, no, I'll talk to him. It'll be quite affordable. So she phoned up her boss and put him on the phone, and he offered it to me for whatever I was about to pay for the camping, which was $30 a night, which was incredibly cheap. Anyway, long story short, I ended up staying at this beautiful two-story chalet type of house overlooking the dunes at the corner of where Highway 6 and 6A meet. So I stayed there, and I sketched out the book while I was there. And when I came home, I was thinking about the house and the owner's name. His name was Ned Bradford. And I gave my protagonist the last name of Bradford. And then I thought, wait a minute, that's also the street, one of the main streets in Provincetown, Bradford Street. And I phoned Janice and I said, listen, does your boss by any chance have anything to do with Bradford Street in Provincetown? And she said, yes, his great-great-great-whatever grandfather came over on the Mayflower and they landed first in Provincetown. And as soon as she told me that, I thought, wow, this book is going to sell really fast. And I finished it in record time. And indeed, it sold about 2 months later. Whereas I'd been struggling to sell my previous books, they took me years to sell. So that was my takeaway from that. Even though it was a comic mystery, I really very much enjoyed writing it. Because it was successful, people wanted sequels. So the next one was Death in Key West, then there was Vanished in Vallarta, and then finally Bon Ton Roulet, which takes place in New Orleans. There are four more planned if I ever get around to writing them. But at some point, I had an editor who said to me, listen, when are you going to take mysteries seriously? And I shrugged and he said, think about it. And I came back to him a few months later with the idea for the first Dan Sharp novel, so which as you have said, is quite dark. So the Bradford Fairfax books are light, they're comic, and the Dan Sharp mysteries are dark and quite serious. So I think that brings out both sides of me, as well as brings out both sides of what mysteries can be. Because as a gay writer, I need the humor. So I can't get by without it. I think there is a lot of humor in the Dan Sharp books as well, but it's deeper, it's buried. But the Bradford stuff, I mean, it's very camp, and they're a lot of fun to write.
Well, even I know in movies, and actually most books I can think of, even the darkest ones have some humor thrown in there, because sometimes the reader or the audience just needs to take a breath, and you got to give that to them. I think that's really important. It's interesting that you were able to tell me the catalyst to write the book, because one of the common questions authors get that they don't like getting is, where do you get your ideas from? And you know the answer to that one. I read a very interesting article where you had an interesting event or an idea that you know how you came up with the idea of Dan Sharp. I'd like to hear that.
Oh, there were a couple of events, I think about a year apart, that led to that book. The first was when I went to, again, campgrounds. I seem to have camp in my background. So I went camping, and while I was at this campground, it's called Cedars. It's outside Hamilton, about an hour and a half from Toronto. I ran into a friend of mine who was there with a new boyfriend. And the friend, Kevin Hartley, is an actor. And he had been starred in a couple of my plays that I produced. And he had just been telling the boyfriend about working in my plays and what my writing was all about. And the boyfriend said, oh, I might have a story for him. And the boyfriend had a story about an ex of his who had committed suicide. He was a gay man in a very repressive marriage, and his wife had tried to take his sons away from him when she found out he was gay. So that was the tragic element that stuck in my memory. And then about a year later, I went on a sailing trip with a couple of friends, and we went to a place called we were in the Bay of Quinte, which is outside a place called Picton in Prince Edward County. And as we were sailing through Quinte, I looked up and I felt this strange tingle as I was looking up at this hill. And I said, what's up there? And they said, oh, that's called Lake on the Mountain. I said, yeah, but what exactly is up there? And nobody really knew, other than it had been at one time a very deep lake with no obvious incoming sources of water, but the level never fell. But more mysterious than that, the level was 17 meters above the water that we were sailing in, which it technically should have been impossible. It should not have been that high. It should have, you know, basically lowered into the Bay of Quinte and drained into it, but it did not. So I was fascinated by the geography and the physical place. And when I got home after the sailing trip, I looked it up to see what it was. Apparently, I guess about 100 years ago or 150 years ago, it had been a torrential waterfall that was compared with Niagara Falls. That's how powerful it was. Since then, it had slowed down, but there were underground sources that fed the lake, this lake on the mountain. So the water came from mysterious places, but it took a long, long time for them to figure it out, because there was no source nearby, even though we were surrounded by water with the Bay of Quinte on the other side, Lake Ontario. That's not where the water came from, strangely enough. I believe eventually they figured out that it came from a couple of hundred miles away through underground streams, through some putting radioisotopes in the water and figuring out where they came from. Anyway, that's what I believe was essentially the source of the water. But it just had this very mysterious quality, especially when I went there for the first time and stood on the mountain looking down at the Bay of Quinte on one side, Lake Ontario on the other side. And I thought, this is really bizarre. This is really strange that this water does not drain. It doesn't. It's an interesting place. It's quite beautiful. Motorboats are not allowed on it. You can swim in it. You can take a paddle boat. You can take a canoe. But it's kept very pristine. And because of that, there's this very eerie calmness about it, because nothing really disturbs the air around it. Nothing really disturbs it with sounds. So it's a place of quiet and almost meditative quality that you can't really get in a city anymore. So when, you know, to me as a city boy for many, many years going there, it's, you hear the wind whistling through the trees and you hear the birds and, you know, people calling far off. And it's just this place that kind of compels you to sit and feel what's going on there and think, you know, what might be happening there to make this water stay where it is. So those were the two main events. And I put them together because when I was there, I started thinking about, what's at the bottom of this lake and who might have been here before me. There's also a native legend that there was a native princess and a brave from opposing tribes, and their tribes did not want them. It was Romeo and Juliet kind of story. Their tribes did not want them to be together, so they eloped, but they were almost captured at Lake of the Mountain. But rather than face capture, they both committed suicide by throwing themselves into the lake. So it's one of these places that is steeped in legend. And as soon as you get there, you feel what's going on there. You just feel it.
It's my understanding, well, Dan Sharp has a disturbing past in some of the subplots. And it's my understanding that some of it hits a little close to home. Do you want to elaborate on that?
I'm not an alcoholic. Dan's a heavy...
I know. You've talked to me a few times about your drinking. So yeah. If you are an alcoholic, you got a problem. But yeah. No, I'm glad you don't.
No, I'm a poor drinker. After three drinks, I'm under the table. So, and nothing to do with my family. My parents were the gentlest, kindest people you could ever imagine. Dan's parents were rather brutal. I grew up in Sudbury, which is a mining town. So I knew a lot of poor kids. I knew a lot of families that were destroyed by alcohol. I shouldn't say a lot, but I did know of kids whose families were torn apart by alcohol. And some parents who were quite brutal. But so Dan's experiences are things that I knew of, and I had seen the effects of those on the kids I grew up with, but they were not personal experiences, not really. But they affected me because I was, because these were my friends and I saw them struggling with some of the things their parents went through. I remember one kid in particular, a guy named Ed, who was my best friend. His parents, I guess, had been World War II refugees who had gone through a lot. And his father was, I guess we would say abusive. I don't know if it was physical, but it was definitely emotional. The father had PTSD from the sounds of it. So Ed would tell me stories about, how horrible his father would be to him. So I did see it, and it sank in a lot. So that when I was creating this character and I wanted to give him an interesting past, these stories naturally came to mind. But again, going into the story, I didn't plan this. These stories came from a place that was very deep inside me, even though they were not my stories. But they were stories that had affected me so strongly, they came out, and they came out when I was writing about Dan Sharp. Before we go on, I'd like to read a work from Threads that I think may be particularly pertinent to your country at this time in light of some of the laws that are being passed now, unfortunately.
Absolutely. I'd love to hear it.
It's called To a Would-Be LGBTQ Teen Suicide. You say you want to kill yourself. You say, I can do this because this is me, because I am. But then you will not be am, just was, not even I anymore. You say no one understands me, no one knows my pain. And maybe that's true right now. How will you do it then? With pills, with rope, or with a bullet if you are American, or maybe with fire or hopelessness? And who will it affect? Your mother, your father, your sister, your brother, your neighbors, your friends? Who else will it kill in turn, like an insidious virus that infects everyone eventually? Your future lovers, your future friends, me? Believe me, I know, because I was the boy who walked down to the harbor at midnight, wanting to throw himself in and let the sea and sky swallow him whole. Because I thought no one cared. Or maybe you're not a teenager, maybe you're an adult or a senior citizen, and you think no one could ever love you, so better to end it here. Maybe. All I know is I was that same boy a year later, driving down an unlighted road, who thought, just the flick of my wrist, and this will all be over. Yes, I can do this if I want to. But no, wait. Something saved me that day, a knowledge of the unseen, a force from above, a kind word, a poem. I don't remember now what it was, just an idea that the fire in my belly would not burn forever, that life could taste sweet once more. So I clung on, my hands shaking on that steering wheel, my sneakers turning back from the water, lapping at my feet, at the edge. I clung on.
In the 2 years that I've done this podcast, you're the first person that's made me cry.
Well, I'm sorry and happy for that at the same time.
No, that was incredible. Okay, thank you. I can't wait to read the rest of the work that you have in Threads. And I'm going to pause here for a moment, and then we'll continue. Before you first published the Bradford Fairfax mystery series, you did some directing, you did some publishing, you did some theater work. But back in the 80s, you wrote, I think it was two novels that involved HIV and AIDS, were very prominent parts of the story, at least in one of those novels. And it was rejected. Do you want to talk about that?
That was the second full-length novel that I wrote. And it dealt with a relationship that I had had in the 80s with someone who was older than me. He was an artist. His name was Michael Riddler. He was quite well known. He exhibited here in Toronto, as well as in New York and in Key West. And he was very successful on a personal, on a professional level. But personally, his life had been very difficult and had been marred by a couple of things, particularly his relationship with his mother, who was an alcoholic, and she had abused him. And he grew up very resentful of her, but very, very much loving towards her. So there was this conflict within him, I think in most of his relationships, trying to sort out the love from the fear and the anger. And ours was quite a tumultuous relationship. Michael, I would credit with having introduced me to many things about life, including travel. I had never traveled before I met him. He really opened my eyes to the world and to artistic things. He was a very good artist. If you come to my house, you'll see my house is filled with many of his paintings, some of them very large size. But our relationship, as I said, was quite tumultuous. And when he died, there was a lot of torment there because of a lot of unresolved feelings. So I put them into a novel. Its eventual title was Queer Zone. And I was trying to deal with the relationship in that, as well as my work in the gay community as an editor working for the paper here, the LGBTQ paper called Extra, and the conflict I felt there, as well as dealing with what was going on in the community when we were losing all our friends and our family and our lovers. And you know, it was pretty horrendous, as many people remember. But once I had finished it, I couldn't find anybody to consider it. There were not a lot of gay publishers back then. There probably were more in the States than in Canada, but I wasn't that familiar with them. So I tried selling it many, many times and eventually gave up. And finally, the first book that I had written, A Cage of Bones, finally that sold. And I thought, well, when that sells, that will open the door to this book, to the subsequent book. But in fact, it never did. I hope someday I may retrieve it and look at it again, but I still think it's a good novel. I hope someday it does get published, whether by myself or somebody else, if I find another publisher willing to do it. It's now a historical novel because it takes place in the late 80s and early 90s. So it's far enough in the past that it would have accrued some kind of patina. You know how these things do when we look back over the years, that people would say, oh, it's a nice time capsule piece. I had intended it to be very current and to be looking in the face of what was going on then. But obviously that that can never happen now. But I think as an historical novel, I think it's still quite interesting. And it's a very strong novel. It's a strong story.
Do you think, as Michael Nava did, he went back and rewrote some of his novels that were written during the 80s because he said now, 40 years later, he sees it all from a different perspective. So when you do pull it out, do you think you may make some changes for maybe the same reasons?
As long as it feels honest to make those changes, just to make it sound more current, I probably wouldn't do that. I would want to be true to the spirit of what I was writing. I'll give you another example. I wrote my first novel when I was 18. It's really a novella. And it was about the struggles I was going through as a young man, not fitting in society, not having come out, not having established any gay relationships. And I reread it after, more than 25 years. I don't remember exactly when I reread it, but I went down to my basement and I was going through my papers and I came across it. And I thought, oh God, this is probably going to be really, really awful. And I thought, no, I'm just going to read it and see what it was. And I was astounded by what I read. Not so much that it was an extraordinary literary work, but I was astounded by the intelligence of that 18-year-old self who I didn't really remember. And I thought, I could never write this now because I'm not that person. But I was quite pleased to see what I had done, given the limited life experience that I had at that time and how sensitively I handled the material that I found I could understand, even if I couldn't relate to the things that that kid was going through, basically. I thought, I explored it really, really well, or the person that I was explored it really, really well. So I think you have to be careful if you're going to edit the material because it's not who you are anymore. It doesn't mean it's not valid for what it was when you wrote it. I think you have to be very careful with that. And that's what I would certainly want to do. Going back to the poems, when Lewis contracted the book and I had to go through them all again, I wanted to revise some of the lines because I'm a more concise writer now than I was. But I didn't want to steal the spirit of the poems and I didn't want to take the emotion out of them. And that's what I had to be very, very wary of, because these poems are very much about an emotional awareness of what I was going through at a particular time, even though in some cases, as I said, it's decades later that they are now being published.
The last time you were on, and actually I was surprised when I saw it, it was back in 2019, right after this show started. You said your poetry has helped you as a novelist. I'm going to ask again because it's been a while. In what ways?
I don't remember what I said then, but I know what I can say now. It gave me a consciousness of words, the power of a single word. So whereas before I might have taken a paragraph to say something, now I can say it in three words, two words, sometimes one word. So it's helped me distill what I'm trying to say. And I think when you get that distillation of words and meaning, it gives the book a resonance. It gives the book a power.
You brought up the 80s. Well, I brought up the 80s and you talked about the AIDS crisis and having lost friends. And I bring this up on the show. I probably should just quit saying it, but I was sheltered in that time. I was in the closet and I lived in the South. So I didn't experience it. In the early 2000s, a friend of mine had HIV, and I slept in the cot every night in the hospital until he died. I'll never forget that experience. It was wonderful to be with him and horrific to see what was going on. And I just can't even imagine seeing that 100-fold or 1,000-fold, like those such as yourself that were out there. I'm not going to ask if you were a survivor because I consider you a survivor. How does it feel to be a survivor?
There was a lot of guilt for a long time, and I think that's what propelled the novel that I was just talking about, Queer Zone. I think that's what propelled me to write it, because I felt guilty that I had survived Michael, even though we were not together when he contracted the virus and died. So guilt is a huge part of it. I can give you a visual image, if you will, this is actually in the book, and this is true. At some point, I picked up an address book and I went through it and I started crossing out the names of all the people who had died or who had disappeared. And it was literally half of the book.
Wow.
And sometimes you never know. I mean, you don't know. Did people just want to escape the city and go somewhere else and were never heard from again? I remember going to a club. I guess I'd been not so social for a while, even though I never left the city. I didn't go out as much as I had. And I ran into somebody I hadn't seen for about 2 years. This was outside a club. It was midnight. And he looked at me and he just said, "Oh, it's you." And I thought, I understand that. I get it. You thought I was gone forever. And here I am. Yeah.
Probably familiar with the Upstairs Lounge fire, took place in New Orleans back in 1973.
Yes.
And I think it was only recently one of the victims' family found out that their son and their brother had died in that fire. He'd left the house, as I think was very common. It's still common today, but in the 70s, much more so, that basically had to leave home and start their own life. They didn't know whatever happened to him for decades, until they just recently found out that he was in the fire. And they can't locate his grave because he was thrown in a pauper's grave. Yeah, pauper's grave, is that what they call them?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I imagine to this day, there's probably families whose children, or one child, had died of the virus. They, to this day, have no idea.
I think if you died in a hospital, there would likely be records. So if you wanted to check up on it, you might be able to do that. But people who died at home and were alienated from families, I think that's more than likely that happened many times.
Yeah, it was very sad in this case. I think he was thrown out of his house.
And I think now you're going back to your friend who was in the hospital. Is that correct?
Yes. And he became a hustler on the streets. In fact, one of the things he said to me, in trying not to have self-pity, he said, "You know, if you're hustling your ass, this is what happens." And what was very disturbing to me was, here his family had thrown him out. They hadn't seen him in quite some time. But when he died, they immediately flew in and took him away. So the small group of us that were friends of his, we just had to have this little sit in the living room service for him. It was pitiful to me that they wanted nothing to do with him while he was alive, but they felt this need to bring him back as a part of their life when he was dead. And I'm sure that was very common back then.
I don't know if I have anything to say about that. I mean, I don't know what their motivation was. Were they concerned that it would look bad for them if they didn't? Or were they worried that maybe he'd left money behind that they might want to claim? I mean, I really don't know. In Michael's case, he had no family, basically. Father had died when he was a kid. Mother was mentally incapacitated by that time due to a long story. But her alcoholism took her down a deep, dark hole, and she suffered a cardiac arrest. And when she was revived, she was brain damaged. So he really had no family to claim him. His friends did claim him. We gave him what we considered a proper send-off. He was eventually cremated and his ashes sown on an island somewhere north of Toronto in the French River. It was a refuge for him when he knew he was dying. He used to go up to spend a lot of time there. So in that case, we were lucky. We claimed him, his collective family. I'm sure more often than not, without power of attorney, which I don't think happened back then very often, families could do whatever they wanted, couldn't they?
Yes, they could. So I kind of took you down this dark path, maybe in a dark mood today. I don't know why. So let's loosen it up a little bit here. Let's go back to Bradford Fairfax,
okay.
Humorous Mysteries that you wrote. Tell us about Bradford. I'd like to hear about him. Well, let's talk about him first.
Okay. While I was in Provincetown on that fateful journey when I decided to write my very first murder mystery, I was walking down a street not far from where I was staying, and I saw a very good-looking man come towards me, and I thought, well, he looks like he could be the hero in a book. So I, as I'm wont to do, I took a surreptitious picture of him, and I still have it to this day. And when I think, what does Bradford look like? He looks like this guy. I have no idea who he was. But I started building on the image of who Bradford was. And as I said, took the first name of the street, the main street in Provincetown, which is Bradford, and just gave him kind of a quixotic last name, Fairfax, like, you know, kind of a lighthearted name. But that was basically where he came from. The story evolved out of strange, as I said, strange people that I met and strange things that happened to me. I remember walking along a street there that didn't have a sidewalk. So I was walking just basically on the edge, on the shoulder of the road. And this very short woman across the street yelled up at me, "You got to watch out, honey. They'll mow you down like wheat here." And literally 10 seconds later, a car just went voom. And I could feel like it just was within inches of my arm. I thought, oh, my God, you're in the book. So she became one of the characters in the book. And literally, I have her say that to Bradford while he's in there. So it was just a little hodgepodge of my vacation. Obviously, there were no murders in the time I was there. But I thought, well, it's a murder mystery. It has to have a murder. So I came up. I invented somebody at that point. But it was fun. And Bradford, I just think, is a very nice, lighthearted guy, the kind of guy you would like to meet in a bar and just say hi to, and maybe more. I mean, you know, he's very attractive, and just hang out with and have fun with. And but he has a serious side too, obviously, because he solves a murder, and that can't be easy for anybody to do. Most people would say, "I'm not getting involved in that," but he says, "No, I want to find out what happened to my ex." You know. Poor guy said he had a drug overdose, and I don't think it was a drug overdose. So he goes to Provincetown to figure out what actually happened.
So in 2011, that's when you wrote Vanish in Vallarta. And before moving on to your fourth novel in that series, the very next year after Vanish in Vallarta was when you wrote Lake on the Mountain, which, by the way, good job, because you got a Lammy for that. Why do you think you made that change at that particular time to go from the funny to the dark?
It was because of those two incidents that I told you about Kevin's boyfriend telling me about this ex of his who had committed suicide. I was very moved by that. And the editor who said, when are you going to take mysteries seriously? And me thinking, okay, I guess that's a hint. So I didn't know at that point that I had it in me to take a mystery seriously, meaning to write something that was gripping and dark and realistic in that vein. My writing is very often humorous. It's humor is sometimes hidden, but for me to go down a very deep, dark road was not something I had contemplated. Then again, let me revise that a little bit, because I had already written the war novel, The Honey Locust, which I mentioned earlier. So that obviously was a very serious book as well. But I think that was more distant from me, because that was about an event that happened in another country. To write about a character who I knew in some way was coming out of myself, even though his biography is not really mine and his temperament is very different from mine, I knew I would have to get closer to home with that. And I didn't know at that point that I was able to do that in the way that was required. I was surprised, happily so. And as you said, it won the Lambda Award in 2013. So I thought, okay, I guess I did an okay job with that.
See what happens when you take writing seriously. And actually, you've brought that up to several people have said, when are you going to take writing seriously? And I take real issue with that. Humor is hard as hell to write.
Well, he didn't say, when are you going to take writing seriously? He said, when are you going to take mysteries seriously? So we'll let him off the hook for that. But he propelled me in the right direction.
There's been many humorous mystery series.
Yes, absolutely.
Most, I think, tend to be cozies. And I don't dislike cozies. I just never get around to reading them. I like PIs. So yeah, that's why I'm like, you've said that several times. Like, no, you're taking it seriously. You're just taking a different route. So there is a question. In your life, you have, as I said earlier, you have been a director, you've been a playwright, you've been a publisher, you've been a songwriter, you've been a poet, and all of these you may still be. I'm saying them as if they're in the past. And a novelist. So when you meet somebody, let's say you're at a party, and you meet somebody for the first time, there's that dreaded question that comes up. And it's dreaded only in the sense that it's kind of a sad way to start a conversation. And that is, what do you do? So we're at a party, Jeff, and I'm going to ask you, what do you do?
Depending on how many drinks I've had, I may say, oh, I work in the arts sector. If I've had a few more, I say, I scribble for a living. And after that, it just goes downhill. I let them take the lead, you know. So what does that mean? What do you mean you scribble? And if they don't follow up, I realized I've met somebody who's really not interested in the answer to the question, and I just leave it there.
Knowing your personality and all the things that you've done and all the traveling you've done, you remind me of Robert Fulghum. Do you know who he is?
Say it again.
Robert Fulghum?
I don't think I do. Should I be embarrassed?
No. You probably are aware of his book, and I may have the first name wrong, but his last name is Fulghum. He wrote the book, Everything I Need to Learn, I Learned in Kindergarten.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes, I do. Okay. I haven't read it, but yes, I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
Okay. He's a great guy. I haven't met him personally, but I know some people that have known him. And the reason you remind me of him is he carries business cards. And when somebody asks for his card, he hands it over, and it has one thing on there, Fulghum. And people are like, what is this? And he said, my job is to be the best Fulghum I can be. And I think of that, and I think of you.
I was just going to say, yes, and I'd like a raise for that job, by the way. But I do try to be the best Jeffrey Round that I can be at all times, you know. So no, you pegged me. Thank you. I take that as a compliment.
I think you should. You seem to really just, whatever it is, and maybe I have you wrong, of what I know of you, you just seem like, not carelessness, but whatever comes along, that's what you're going to go with when it feels right.
I like adventure. So if you throw a curve at me, I will follow it, as long as it's, you know, not too horrendous or reckless. I like to follow to see where things are going and see what comes up. To me, that's the magic of living. And also it's the magic of writing.
Jeff, we are reaching the end of the show, and before I let you go, I always have to have awkward questions authors get. If you remember, I spin the wheel and you get a question that I don't want to go into, we'll just say authors get that are awkward or make us feel uncomfortable that we hear from time to time. So if you're going to hold still, I will spin the wheel.
Go right ahead.
Okay, I have your question here. How come I've never heard of you?
Oh, the answer is so short, because I'm Canadian.
You blame being Canadian for people not knowing you as a writer?
Well, I blame it for Americans not knowing me as a writer. Sorry, people from the United States. We don't translate down there as well as we might like. Winning the Lambda opened a lot of doors for me, as you can well imagine. But until then, I was not. I didn't have a big presence in the U.S. But that has changed. Other than that, I don't know. That question doesn't make me uncomfortable. It makes me want to have an answer to that. But I don't really have one other than the one I've given you.
So let's say it's awkward.
For you for asking, not for me, because I think, well, why the hell not?
Because you need to read more. That's why you don't know who I am.
No, I think you read a lot. I think you read an awful lot. I don't know how people discover authors that they haven't heard of. I used to discover them through the reviews, one of which you mentioned, the Church Wellesley Review, which I started in the 90s. That was the first journal for creative writing from the queer community in Canada. So I came across a lot of names that I still know to this day. Now I find things out on the internet, but only by scrolling and just seeing what other people are talking about. Facebook, for instance. Sometimes on Goodreads, I get things sent to me on Goodreads, or I will be looking up something on Amazon that I'm interested in and something else will be recommended to me. I'm not a member of any book clubs, so I can't say that. But friends recommend things to me quite often. You'd be surprised. Well, no, you probably wouldn't. How many people tell you, you must read this or you must read that? Very often, if they know my taste, I'm grateful that they send the recommendations my way. But there are some people who clearly don't know my taste and send me titles. I just think, no, not in a million years. I'm sorry. That comes my way a lot too. They'll say, as you said with Robert Fogum, you say, well, how come I've never heard of him? And I have no answer for that. I can't say it's ignorance because I don't leave stones unturned. I'm looking for new names and new authors all the time. I very often keep my ears open for prize winners or people who make the short list of various prizes, you know, whether it's the Pulitzer Prize or the Lambda Award or the Booker Award. I want to know who's on those lists and I want to know why they are on those lists. The suggestions for new books and new authors come from many different places. And I guess maybe you don't hang around in the same social circles I do, which is a given considering you live on the other side of the continent from me. I come down there often enough, but it's not been in the last 3 years, has it, unfortunately?
Well, I'm quite pleased that I know you.
And thank you, and me too. And we will have to meet up. And I have to say, California is pretty much my favorite place on earth. I can say that without telling a lie.
That's a lot of fun. I'm not near the beaches anymore, but I'm not far.
I love mountains too.
Not far from those either.
Yeah, great.
Usually I have the awkward questions as the last question, but you kind of triggered something regarding reading reviews and that sort of thing. It wasn't on a podcast. Michael Nava and I were chatting actually just the other day, and he said that one of his frustrations now is magazines that would like him to write something tell them they're not interested in book reviews or book recommendations because nobody's interested in those anymore. And I found that surprising because I get messages on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook Messenger. I get people that go to my contact page. Some people know my email. Which is brad@bradshreve.com. Overwhelmingly, I get this, thank you so much for your show because Justine's recommendations have really opened some books up to me and new authors, and people you've interviewed have opened me up to new authors. And I found that baffling. Have you experienced that people are saying they're not interested in that anymore?
I don't very often write reviews, though having said that, the most recent thing that was published in a magazine of mine was a review of the new fiction pieces that were discovered written by Marcel Proust that were taken out of his first book, Plaisir et Jour. I don't know if I'm saying that properly. So it was more than 100 years old. I talk about books and writers all the time to people. So if they don't want to hear about it, they're going to have to tell me to stop. But I don't write a lot of reviews. I will recommend by word of mouth, because that way I can look people in the eye and say, listen, you really need to pay attention to this person, because this person is really going to be a good writer. So I'm happy to do that. Whether people read reviews anymore, my friends do, because I hear about them all the time. But I, like many of your listeners, are very grateful for the names that I don't know that come from your podcasts and from your shows now and in the past, because I think far too many people are recommending writers that we all know. Mm-hmm. So I would rather hear about the writers that we don't know. You know, we all have our opinions about the books we've read. Tell me about the books that I haven't read and why I should read them. I will be eternally grateful for that.
Yeah, I had a listener send me a message. It was on Twitter. And he said, I keep seeing notices for all these public readings, or actually they're Zoom these days. And it's always the same small group of people. I will tell him he's right. And they're brilliant writers. But I can tell you from the show, what people really like is finding authors they never heard of, or finding new authors that they find are good. So I wish the powers that be would have more new authors out traveling.
I'm with you there.
So it has been great. You and I tend to stay in touch through Messenger and emails, and it's great to talk to you face-to-face, even if it's through a computer screen. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and thank you for coming back.
Thank you for a very enjoyable show.
If you enjoy Queer Writers of Crime, let others know and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. It's easy by clicking Love the Podcast in the show notes. If you prefer another app, you can click the same link to see if they offer them. Who knows? Brad may just read yours on the air.